For the rest of this hour and for the next week, a journey beyond normal. Remarkable feats performed by fearless men and women missing limbs, bones, and sight who compete in the Paralympics, which get underway today. From being unable, they have crafted new events that take their bodies way beyond normal. 80 Americans, 45 nations, 5 sports. Next week, we'll hear from some of the athletes with their customized bodies and radical custom-fitted gear. But first, the games have come a long way. Today, they may be pushing human and machine limits. But in the beginning, Dr. Ian Britton, author of The Paralympic Games Explained, says it was all about giving war victims something to do.
Well, the Paralympic movement in general actually grew out of the rehabilitation of Second World War victims of conflict, mainly soldiers, but some civilians as well, who were received spinal injuries during the Second World War. They were the brainchild of Dr. Ludwig Guttmann, a German-Jewish neurologist who escaped Nazi Germany in 1939. Came to the UK and in 1944 was asked to head up the National Spinal Rehabilitation Unit in Great Britain. And as part of his rehabilitation process, he actually introduced sport for a number of reasons. One, because it was very good for the physical health of the individuals, because prior to that, most of them had just been left lying in beds with no expectations that they would even live, let alone live productive lives. And also as a way of showing the non-disabled population what people with disabilities were actually capable of, because most people, particularly at that time, were sort of socialized to believe that if you became disabled, you were almost basically on the scrap heap of life.
And in the beginning, was the Paralympics more of a recreational outlet? How was the level of competition? And we've seen some pretty ruthless competition in the Paralympics in our time.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's moved on significantly since the early days. I mean, it was more about recreational and rehabilitational sport. Obviously, as we've developed, you know, it really now is just, it is elite sport of the highest level. The athletes train just as hard. They're just as determined to win medals. They're just as proud to represent their country at the Paralympic Games as the Olympians are.
Do you think that it helps or hurts the Paralympic movement to be paired with the able-bodied Olympics summer and winter?
My honest opinion would be that it wouldn't be in the position it's in today without that linkage. I think the linkage has helped significantly develop the Paralympic movement, both in terms of the actual sort of management and structure, but also, you know, in gaining media coverage, in gaining interest and acceptance from countries around the world. Whether that's still the case, you know, going forward in a couple of decades' time, that's a more difficult, more interesting question, possibly.
One of the things I wonder, and this is something that a lot of athletes have told us, is there just seems to be people having a lot more fun at the Paralympics. There's just a greater diversity of athletes, people who just got into the sport, people who spent their life doing the sport, and they're all together out there on the ice and snow.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And that's true of the Summer Games as well, I think. You know, I mean, I heard a story from a Paralympic athlete once, a blind athlete. He won numerous gold medals on the track. And he was talking to a guy in a pub who was vastly overweight, you know, drinking sort of 8 pints a night, probably not very healthy. And the guy was asking him what he did. And he told him he was a Paralympic athlete. And the guy sort of said, oh, what's your distance? And at the time, it was 1,500 meters. And the guy said, oh, what sort of time do you run? And bearing in mind, this guy's totally blind, he'd run under 4 minutes 10 for a 1,500 meters. And the guy's response was, oh, that's not bad. I think I might struggle to do that. You know, I think there's a lack of comprehension of just how good these athletes are.
Oh, that is amazing. Dr. Ian Britton, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Ian Britton is author of The Paralympic Games Explained, and he's a research fellow at the Coventry University in England. Pushing the edge of human capability regardless of any rules is certainly the mission of people who compete in the X Games.
Here comes T.J. Schiller. Temporary tornado. Stop it, buddy.
Oh, my God.
What in the wide world of sports was that?
1620, ladies and gentlemen.
The history has just been set at X Games here. There's never been a 1620 executed in any competition.
That's Canadian freestyle skier T.J. Schiller making history with a double cork 1620 during the 2011 Winter X Games. And when American skateboarder Danny Wei encounters a wall, he just goes over it.
On that ramp in particular in China, were very substantial to the point where I almost could barely handle the quarter putt. The first time I made the jump over the wall, like in the air, I knew I was going to make it. But it was kind of surreal to end up in China. It just seemed too good to be true.
The wall there, that was simply the Great Wall of China. And for Mandy Ray Cruikshank, needing to breathe 289 feet underwater is merely a detail.
When I first started freediving, for me it was just being able to see if I could do that extra few seconds of breath hold or extra few feet of depth. I didn't really have goals of being a world record holder or doing any of the things I had done.
Cruikshank holds the depth record for freediving on a single breath. The door you step through to get beyond traditional biological limits is known by all of these athletes. It's called flow. The mental state of being totally immersed in an activity or a mission. Can humans control and direct their own states of flow? Stephen Kotler is the author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. He says being able to switch the state of flow on and off to maximize performance and creativity is what this new science is all about.
I think we're pushing the limits of what's possible. Back in the early 90s when this kind of acceleration started, there was always this feeling, the journalists who were covering this was, oh, it's got to end. There's no way this can keep going. This has got to be the apex. And year after year after year after year, in pretty much all of the action and adventure sports that you can think of, surfing, mountain biking, skiing, snowboarding, went on and on and on. Even the new sports, parkour, things like that. The level of performance has just gone up and up and up and up. And most people, because they don't really pay attention to action and adventure sports, haven't really noticed.
How does this idea of flow throw out the rule book of what we would think biomechanically human beings and human bodies are capable of?
Well, at the elite level of performance, and we've known this for a long time, performance is obviously much more mental, right? So flow is this state of optimal performance where we feel our best and perform our best, and it's a huge mental shift. So at the elite levels, fitness is pretty much on par. Everybody's kind of – they're all in great shape. The difference is the mental edge, and flow is the ultimate mental edge. We're talking about kind of extreme attention, right? This is the end state. But flow is, you know, now demarcated by a number of different fundamental brain states, things going on in the brain.
Time stops.
Time slows down. Your sense of self disappears.
You're at one with whatever it is you're doing.
And we now know the neurobiology of that. So it used to sound really silly, right? Why does time slow down, or why does self disappear, or how do people talk about becoming one with everything, or surfers like, dude, I was one with the wave.
It's a complete hipster term, but there is neurobiological evidence that flow is a meaningful state in the human mind.
If we want to talk about meaning, that evidence goes back 150 years. We knew in the late 1870s through the turn of the century, William James worked on flow states back then. He didn't quite know what he was looking at.
He took a lot of drugs.
He did take a lot of drugs. But he also worked on flow states. And, you know, one of the things he figured out very early on is it doesn't matter how fantastical these experiences sound, they are significantly psychologically real. Psychologists say people are more complex on the other side of a flow state, which is basically a way of saying it fundamentally alters you, these experiences.
So in this book, who did you meet that kind of blew you away?
All the athletes in the book blew me away. There's no way around it. I was particularly impressed by Dean Potter. He's a great example. He's a rock climber. And one of the things that sets these athletes apart, most people when they have a flow experience, it's a walk on a moon. It's, oh my God, what is going on? This is a profoundly altered state. But these athletes are getting into this state so reliably that they're figuring out how to stretch it, how to use it, how to expand it.
Toggle it on and off.
Toggle it on and off. And Dean, you know, at a time when most of rock climbing, the upper edge, they were doing some free soloing, which is climbing without ropes, and they would do 100-foot pitches, 200-foot pitches, 300-foot pitches. Dean went down to Patagonia alone and started free soloing huge mountains, 2,000, 4,000-foot walls. And he would do one climb, and then he would literally, like, hike across a glacier, not sleep, and do another climb. So, like,
In a sense, you can understand that. I mean, above whatever 80 feet, it's closed casket anyway. So 2,000 feet
doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah.
But what he was able to do, and a lot of these athletes can do, is flow states for most people 20 minutes, an hour. You know, he was able to hold on to these things and stay in the zone for 2, 3, 4 days at a time.
Wow.
And perform at an elite level the entire time. That's incredible. And that's, you know, that's A, what's possible for all of us with flow, right? But that's why these guys are such great case studies, because you're like, okay, here's a guy who has figured out how to stay in this state of optimal performance for days and days at a time. Let's study him and figure out what he's doing, which was kind of the project that led to Rise of Superman.
One of the issues of flow is that it kind of erases the dualities of mind-body, of body-machine, of object-subject, and that in many ways one of the most interesting conversations you had was with Hugh Herr at the Media Lab up at MIT, who's into this biomechatronics, trying to merge humans and machines together to produce a sort of enhancement. How does flow figure into these prosthetic enhancements for people whose bodies are presumably less capable than those of able-bodied folks?
What it does is this is for everybody, and this is – use work is so exciting for this reason. Most athletes, for example, let's just start with athletes, they don't usually come to flow and kind of the psychological and mental game till late in their careers. Usually they're driven there by injury or something else. They start getting into the mental game, or once they have to start competing with people who are 18 years old and they're 30, they get more into the mental game. But what happens is your body starts to break down. So just as you're starting to master the mental game and really use these states to extend performance, your body's falling apart. What you've done by taking kind of bionics that was developed for soldiers and turning it into kind of strap-on exoprosthetics that anybody can use as we get older and that sort of thing, is he's allowing us to become flow hackers way, way, way into our 60s, into our 70s, into our 80s.
It's flow hackers.
That's the term we've been using for it.
Have you flow hacked into yourself?
I have gotten – well, you know, I make my living as a writer, and creativity is – you know, truly great creativity I think is impossible without deep flow. So some of this for me was also necessity. I wanted to understand these states because we know from kind of preliminary research that my organization, the Flow Genome Project, has done – there's all kinds of creativity research that's out there, but we just took a look at like how jacked up is creativity and flow. And it's just a broad general survey, and not hard numbers yet, but the average we're hearing is 7 times, so 700% more creative inflow than out of flow. And this sort of jives with what other researchers have done. So to me, you know, getting up every day, having to face a blank page, knowing how to get into flow quickly is survival as a writer.
Around the house, does that create some tension when your wife tries to say, take out the garbage, and you go, hey, I'm in flow, don't bother me?
No, I take out the garbage. I can take out the garbage in flow.
In flow.
Yeah, I'm that good.
That very good. Stephen Kotler, author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.